white man standing on the shores of the sea asking a non-white person who's trying to swim in, but why do you want to come here? You know, and the person answers, because you were there first. And I think this is something that very often gets erased, like when the way you presented it now. And I think something very similar is going on in Germany also with that language of these are not part of our culture, right? These people do not belong here, and therefore they get to be deported, oppressed in different ways, persecuted. It's the again, that blind spot, that erasure, that forgetting, that all that we are experiencing now in terms of crises, global crises, were caused by that expansion of European colonial powers. So thank you for bringing up also, particularly in Switzerland, which always presents itself as never having participated, but as you say, Sasa, and the money's here. Somehow they are, have always been participating, actually. I don't know if you want to add anything to each other, which you are always welcome to do, by the way.
Maybe just a small point, actually, on, I don't know, zooming out, and when we look at kind of how, we talk about this like first wave of colonial expansion, mm-hmm. and this, and obviously the panel today is about its continuities. When we look at a resource extraction, it's definitely this invisible kind of hand of whiteness mm-hmm. that is at work. Like when you look at the EU, for example, I mean, how many people in this room know where, I don't know, here in Switzerland, like where do we get our energy from? Mm-hmm. Obviously, some of it will be produced internally, but a lot of it will be, you know, imported. In the EU Green Deal, 50% of the projected green energy for their like 2030 kind of let's reduce our carbon footprint plans are going to be imported from outside of Europe. It's time that we kind of unpack what are the connotations of that. And the connotations are, you know, another wave of imperialism and colonialism that if we don't intervene could be just as seismic as the ones that we've seen historically and that are, you know, ongoing. And it is this kind of like, yeah, this invisibility, this kind of, this obscuring, it all happens in policy and in bureaucracy. So we don't actually like see how this energy is being produced, but if we kind of follow the threads, we'll see that it is absolutely the same structures of violence that are playing out like on macro scales as well as in kind of smaller ways, as mm-hmm. Salson, yeah, just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me pick up. I actually wanted to go more into this, the question of extraction of resources, and it was something I think that you mentioned actually when we talked previously to prepare this talk, and I remember Tariq mentioning something similar that is, again, this is always interlinked. So I think we have already touched upon it, but maybe we can go more specifically into something that comes across now in that law that just passed, which is imprisoning people, so the containment practices, excluding people, saying these people are a threat and they should be deported or they should be imprisoned. So that is also a lot part of how this ongoing colonial relationship functions. And so maybe that's a question that I would address to all of you, actually, how important it is to think about these practices of exploiting other countries, other nations, and the practice of colonial violence so you exploit and at the same time you imprison, at the same time you exclude, you create barriers. So what would be for you the importance of addressing colonial violence in your work? How do you connect that with your focus? And maybe Tariq, you can start. So really the question of what is the importance of colonial violence for Global South United? How do you address it?
Okay, very good question. So, as I said, our work is quite responsive to our surrounding, which is Berlin and Germany, and also on a larger scale, the Imperial Core. But, so, in that sense, a big part of our work goes towards awareness surrounding the Palestinian cause, but at the same time, there are actually other struggles that people, whether in Europe or in the global north or elsewhere, they don't know much about what's going on even. They don't know that there is also a genocide happening right now in Sudan or in Congo, and the fact that this is also happening, like, out of the same concept, the same colonial violence, the same extractivism, the minerals and that are needed for electronic devices, batteries, and all this. And again, another part of it is connecting how all this is interlinked, like how Zionist or Israeli colonial violence in Palestine is actually linked to colonial violence in Congo, or how US and colonial violence and colonial influence in the Arab world has an influence on the war and the genocide in Sudan. Mm-hmm. So I'm not an expert on Congo or Sudan, unfortunately, but I can also perhaps highlight how even in Palestine, it's not just an argument about, some Jewish people wanting to have this land for themselves. It's much larger than this, and what is actually aiding this genocide to keep going is, again, extractivist practice. Perhaps afterwards, Holly can speak more about how concessions of land in Palestine to offer energy contracts to European gas companies, for example, are also at the core of this ongoing horror. And also touching upon the idea of colonial continuity, this wasn't the first of it, and it wasn't always about gas. Like, it's just, different times, different resources sort of thing. And even before the Zionist occupation of Palestine, the British before that also did the same violent extractivist practices. Perhaps it wasn't natural gas then, it was electricity, it was water, land, railway networks and infrastructure that was connecting the southern Mediterranean coast. And I think for us also in Global South United, it's important to understand how this web of colonial practices intersect, because ultimately it is weapons manufactured in Germany, in the US, which these states are, using basically our money, our taxpayer money, as they call it, to fund the genocide of our people, which is, if you think about it, it's not just oppressive. I think it goes beyond humiliating if you look at this in an abstract sense. It's like someone forcing you to use your own tools against you in a very violent way. I don't want to use a harsher analogy because it might be too much, but
I think you can. Go there. Just go all the way.
But yeah, that there is something psychopathic. I mean, do you, for example, remember the bully in the school who would hold your hand and make you hit yourself with your own hand, for example? Mm-hmm. This is pretty much how it feels right now. And I think if you also start to look at it a bit from the external observer perspective, we have become also the resources to these states. Like, it's all the talk about human rights and democracy, it's becoming very clear that it's all a farce. And maybe it wasn't as clear 10 years ago or something when everyone all over Europe was like, yay, Arab Spring, long live the resistance, but not every resistance really. And yeah, it's very sad to think about even.
Thank you, Tarek. Would you like to pick up?
I'd love to jump in on a couple of the points you made, firstly on the Congo and then secondly on Gaza. So I don't know if anyone saw, but recently, just near Berlin, there were these massive occupations against the Tesla factory that Elon Musk and his cronies were trying to build. And one of the big arguments against the factory being built was that it would fell 500,000 trees to build 500,000 cars or something like that. And there was a little bit of analysis in the discourse about where the cobalt would come from that would, you know, that is the key mineral that would be in those cars. And it feels like somehow we're just kind of sometimes centering slightly the wrong thing at the core of our analysis, because it is that cobalt mining and it's the interventions from like US-backed militias in the Congo that are fueling the genocide there and enabling factories like Tesla to do their thing. And obviously that is devastating for communities in Berlin, but that's perhaps a drop in the ocean compared to what's going on with the ongoing genocide in Congo. So yeah, I guess just one really clear connection there that we can make, you know, with the importance of colonial violence in our energy systems and in all of our extractivist markets as well. The point on Gaza, I think, again, it presents this case really clearly. So even before the genocide, the EU was agreeing energy import deals with Egypt so they could kind of export so-called Israeli gas via Egypt into Europe. And the reason for that was because, you know, we had the ongoing Russian siege on Ukraine, and Europe needs to like diversify its energy sources to protect its future energy security. So where does it look to? It looks to you know, the Middle East and the Zionist entity to basically export stolen Palestinian gas. Mm-hmm. And this is become exacerbated in the genocide, where we've seen European companies such as British Petroleum, an Italian-based Eni, for example, like in the first month of the genocide, was signing exploration deals with, you know, Netanyahu's government to explore for more gas off the coast of Gaza, while people were dying in their thousands upon thousands. So I think it kind of makes this point that our energy system, and if we look at our energy system as sort of the material base of this broader system of genocidal racial capitalism, which is what we should call it, because that is what is happening in Palestine, in the Congo, and elsewhere in other ways and in other kind of cadences. The kind of opportunistic, like vulture capitalism is becoming intensified as the kind of realms of acceptability stretch, and as capitalism as well kind of creaks and buckles under this kind of moment that we're in, which is one of increasing resource scarcity, of intensifying climate crisis, all of these things conflating together to also intensify the way in which people are racialized again, as we saw in colonial times, and if they ever formally ended, which of course they didn't. But a bit of a ramble. Another example, I was kind of making loads of notes while Tariq was talking. Another example on green energy and border regimes. So I don't know if anyone's heard of Desert Tech, but it's a kind of massive like solar kind of energy corporation that are trying to build out these like enormous solar farms in several countries across North Africa. And research revealed a couple of years ago that Desert Tech were like having kind of negotiating talks with Frontex, the EU's border control agency, about how the kind of rollout of massive solar panels would dispossess people, and then how Frontex would negotiate the, you know, the enormous kind of surge of people who might then come to Europe to look for a place to live because their home has been taken by an imperial corporation again. So we're seeing these things happen like across the world in so many different sectors, and it's really important for us, you know, if we've got our eye on kind of also like with climate politics, if we're advocating for a green transition, solar power sounds absolutely great, but we really need to look into the intricacies of how it's produced, because it could be just as bad, if not worse, as what we saw with the fossil fuel industry. Yeah, and just another final thing, there are just so many examples. Again, this securitization and the connections with the Israeli settler colonial regime as well. We Smell Gas last summer were doing some research with some comrades that we met in northern Greece who were resisting a onshore gas extraction plant that was being built on their land in northern Greece in a place called Epirus. It's one of the few places where people still claim indigeneity in Greece. The company that was securing the gas infrastructure was Elbit Systems, which is the, Israel's biggest weapons manufacturer. So we're seeing these things play out and this kind of, genocidal imperialism disperse and diffuse across global capitalism, like, as well as in more acute ways in Gaza and in the Congo.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Samson, would you like to add from your perspective?
Yeah. From the Foulard Violet perspective, is actually if we look at everything that's happening globally from the lens of Switzerland and from also the lens of the political system in Switzerland, which is a semi-direct democracy, is like the core of everything is really hypocrisy in a way, mm-hmm. because Switzerland's political system is based on very, very large influx of money from companies and political parties. Usually the industries are the pharmaceutical industry, the banking and the insurance industry. So these are kind of like the pillar of the Swiss politics, let's say. And also what's actually quite cynical in a way is that lobbying in Switzerland is actually very much open and very much praised, because every parliamentary has two tickets to give to anyone that he wants to have access to the other politicians, and usually you will have 2/3 of the people in parliaments are lobbyists, generally from one of those three industries or something similar, with 1/3, I don't do maths very good. So it's 2/3 and 1/3 would be the elected people. And so in that configuration, you just kind of think about, but who are you serving? Are you serving the people or are you serving the lobbies? Are you serving the industries? And that kind of goes also into like how politicians are usually very cynical when they come with ideas in order to, let's talk about diversity. Let's talk about inclusion. Let's talk about let's fight racism. One of the cynical examples that we've seen is that the SVP party and the Liberal Party. I'm really sorry. I should have researched their names in English or in German. But they've never really been very keen to talk about anti-Semitism and to actually put that into law. But whenever it was very good to use that tool in order to in order to legitimize Islamophobia, so that's where they jump on that bandwagon. And that kind of thing is that, in a way, when you also talk with politicians, because that's one of our work, we do lots of lobbying with parliamentaries and elected people, it's very, very funny to kind of look at them in the eye and try to plead with them that we're also human beings. And they're like, yeah, but my career. Like, and the thing is that it's not even a joke. We've talked with people about some stuff, like some very, very important things, such as the access to the public, sphere. So, for example, swimming pools are like, it's as if swimming pools have been the battlefield of the Western values. Like, you have to be in a bikini in order to enter, because otherwise it's like a threat to everything that the Western world knows. And so we've been just pleading with and talking with people by saying, listen, there's some people that actually don't feel comfortable in a swimsuit. There are some women that don't feel comfortable in a swimsuit. So why not allow people to just diversify? Here we can talk about diversity. I don't want to see the same H&M swimsuit everywhere. I want to see other brands, and other brands maybe a bit more covering or less covering, or what. I don't care. Just give me real diversity. And they're like, no, but you. And then they kind of bring in like this kind of really weird language about cleanliness and culture and people not feeling at ease. And then you're just like, okay, but if you can even make them allies, they are not very vocal because they're very scared about the perception that they would have when they become allies to against Islamophobia. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like the thing where sometimes I've been talking with politicians and they're in demonstrations against, like, for peace. Mm-hmm. Peace of what? I don't know. But like, they're like, for peace. And you're talking to them and you're like, before you go for peace, just like, include the people that are your constituent that actually just want to go to the swimming pool. And for me, it's the same thread that you're not allowing a certain section of your own constituent, people that are paying taxes, to have access to their freedom and liberties, to have access to the public sphere, and promoting genocide. It's literally the same thread. So you can't tell me that a politician that is cowardly enough to look at you in the eye and tell you that he's thinking about his career, and you tell me that he is actually pro-peace. All of them have personal interest, and that personal interest is really linked to, exactly like you said, so it's linked to the capitalist system that we live in, it's linked to the political greed, it's linked to anything that is that has to do with white supremacy, and what they love to do is to push someone that doesn't look white, but that is very much acting like a white supremacist. And they will tell you, but look, she or he is with me, so you must be in the wrong. And I'm like, he's just your puppet. So we're like in this kind of Uncle Ben kind of situations where it's exactly what's happening now with the US. We had, like, Joe Biden is out, but now we have Joe Biden number two, which is a brown woman. Like, for me, diversity is not in the decoration. Just give me real diversity in ideas. But if you give me the same idea, but just decorate it into different wrapping, I mean, at the end of the day, it's just a farce. And that's what we've been... I'm sorry if I'm taking too much time, just you cut me, because sometimes I can go on a tangent. But it's for me, it is exactly the same thing and the same conversations that we've had with the representation of Muslim women and women wearing the headscarf. They'd be like, oh, but look, there's an H&M model wearing a headscarf. You should be very happy. Actually, no, because I know exactly that the clothes that you're doing have nothing to do... Like, there was no Muslim woman in the real building of that product. And also, your product is actually made on the back of other Muslim women, probably, you know. Mm-hmm. So the decorative diversity is actually really, it's very difficult also to go against it in a way, because you're just like, but you need to promote all of these diverse people. You need to promote like the LGBTQ plus community having to do campaigns for whatever brand. And I'm just like, you just want to be a money-making machine for other people, because at the end of the day, it's the same shit. It's exactly the same thing. And having people really understand that the core of the problem is capitalism and white supremacy, and everything that is made in Switzerland is actually in the service of that, including all of the anti-racist law, etc. They will never do a law if it is not again, if it is not for their own goods. And when I say own goods, I'm talking about the 2/3 of the people that are lobbying in the parliament. Mm-hmm. It's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. So we should just take the streets forever.
Hey,
that's
hey.
That's a suggestion.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard in all of your contributions now the word interest several times, and I think that's again what becomes visible. Certain political interests, certain economic interests, geopolitical interests are defended, and they still perpetuate again they've always perpetuated the imbalance of power between what Yutari called the imperial core, so between the global north and the global south. So all these practices we are talking about are finding ways of continuing those relationships. And Sasan, you were already hinting at something that would be my next question, a bit more specific than to the work you're doing, all of you differently, which is the issue of consciousness raising and awareness campaigns and the awareness work you have to do that is always also resisting certain dominant discussions and ideas about Western civilization or democracy or free market economy or even freedom or peace, as you mentioned. So all these words are used very frequently to talk about the superiority, let's put it this way, also of the global north. And I was wondering, like, if we go now more specifically into some of these ideological struggles, I would say, or how things get defined and who gets to define them. And I thought I would throw a specific question to each one of you about the work that your organizations, your groups are doing. And I would start with maybe Tarek, because currently you've already hinted at that. We all know it. We have this immense discussion about what constitutes anti-Semitism. It's one of these words that's now being used to create all kinds of divisions. And maybe many of you have become aware that in the past few days there's been quite a lot of discussion about this new statement that is being prepared by the parties in power, CDU, SPD, Die Grünen and FDP, that claim to want to defend what they consider Jewish lives against what they call anti-Semitism. And many critics, including Jewish activists, writers and scholars living in Germany, are pointing out that this law is actually targeting, and I quote from the protest letter that Jewish intellectuals and artists wrote, they say this law is targeting leftist politics and those who come from outside of Germany. So again, uncovering the interests, right? And anyone who criticizes the state of Israel. So I was wondering for you specifically, Tarek, and for Global South United, what does it mean to do the work of awareness campaigning at this particular moment in Germany? What challenges do you face?
Mm-hmm. So I would also bring this back to the term of interest. And I imagine most of you would be familiar with the term Staatsraison, something very big in Germany right now. Staatsraison like would literally be translated as reason of the state, but it doesn't quite mean that. It's loosely translated to national interest, or I would translate it even as maybe the purpose of the state. And this is usually the red card that white people in Germany always put out whenever the argument for, you know, maybe let's not participate in the mass murder of an entire population. No, but sorry, this is our Staatsraison. We have to kill them for now. And it's very funny also how this is becoming a monopoly over the discourse of what constitutes anti-Semitism. Imagine how ridiculous it would be if a white person would explain to you what racism is and tries to convince you that you are racist. And by you, I mean a non-white person. And of course, there's a lot of theories about this monopoly over the discourse. Some social scientists would argue that, you know, this is the transaction, like an actual financial transaction, that Germany pays off Israel and then Israel allows Germany to utilize or instrumentalize this discourse to whitewash the guilt and all the Vergangenheitsbewältigung and all this shit. But then